You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Hey everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. A couple months ago, I had this book show up at my office. I get a lot of books show up in the office. And this one had a nice like handwritten note. Hey, I think you'll really like this book. Then I got the same book again a little while later. It's like, hey, I think you'll really like this book. You should really talk to the author. It went in the stack. It looked interesting. Then there was an article in The Atlantic that came out. I can't even remember the title of it, but it had growth Ponzi scheme in it. And I got to tell you, like 50 people sent it to me and said, hey, you guys should, you should look into this. Then a similar article came out in the New York Times, not the same one, but a different one kind of theme. And like 100 people sent that one to me. I'm finally talking to the author. Benjamin Harold wrote the book Disillusioned: Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs. Ben, welcome to the Strong Towns Podcast.
It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to confess something to you right off the top. I probably do one or two interviews a week. I don't remember ever chatting with you.
We did.
It definitely made a big impression on me.
And so I had been familiar with your work and with Strong Towns' work. And, you know, definitely it was informing my thinking as I kind of went along and started this project. But then when we spoke, it was like, oh, wait, there was really a powerful thing of like the, particularly the growth Ponzi scheme argument that you've advanced really helped click into place a lot of what I was seeing in the suburban communities I was following. So yeah, absolutely grateful and a fan of your work. And I'm glad that we're able to connect here now.
Thank you. Let me start out with this. You're a fantastic writer. I mean, you're really a very good writer. Just the way you approach a subject, the way you digest it, the way you explain it, it's very evocative. It captures you. It's a really good read. Can you, just for my own benefit, are you a reporter? Like, what's your background? You're clearly like very gifted at writing. So I'd like to know where that comes from.
Well, I appreciate the compliment. And yeah, I've worked as an education journalist for the last 15 years. I started covering School District of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, where I'm based, and then went on to Education Week, where I covered K-12 schools nationally. But two things with that. So in my education reporting career, I also worked in radio. So part of that is storytelling and character and voice. And I had done some documentary filmmaking before, and also as a policy researcher. So this was definitely a project where all of these different strands of my life kind of came together. And I think was a helpful way to kind of tell this story in a way that hopefully policy wonks will appreciate and get with, but also that everyday suburban families in particular will see themselves in this as well.
But like the audience targeting was a regular folk kind of audience. This is not an academic book in the sense that I don't think it will, maybe some college course will pick it up. The way you created these vignettes of these different families in these different locations and followed them through kind of different scenes, this was a tough book for me to get through. It was a challenging read. It's a hard read. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose this approach? And maybe just talk a little bit about the approach, because I think people listening to this, this is a different book for me. Most of the books that I read are like solid nonfiction, almost geeky. This reminded me of Buried My Heart at Wounded Knee in the sense that it was this narrative where every page I was like, no, stop doing that. And then it's like, oh my gosh, not really. And it just kind of built on itself. What was your inspiration? What was your approach? What were you trying to accomplish with the way you set this up?
Let me start with the inspiration question, because this really takes me back to my own personal origin story. So I grew up in a post-war suburb of Pittsburgh called Penn Hills. It's directly east of Pittsburgh, shares a boundary with the city. And it, you know, had been farmland and hillsides and abandoned coal mines until right after the war. And then all of a sudden, as part of the post-war boom, it was subdivisions and single family homes. So my family moved in there in the 70s. And I'm white. My parents were white. We moved in at a time when the community was still 90% white. And it worked very well for us. I mean, it worked well for us financially and materially, but really where it worked best was in the public school system. And it was a school system that had really been developed in our own image in many ways. Like, I tell lots of stories in the books about how not just that I got opportunity, but also got this kind of grace and understanding and forgiveness that opened lots of doors for me and gave me lots of second chances. And so I graduated from Penn Hills in 1994, and then I left, and I really didn't look back. I couldn't wait to get out of suburbia. I couldn't wait to get out into the real world and see where things were really happening. And I started my career in journalism. And so it wasn't until 20 years later, around 2015, when all of these headlines started coming out of Penn Hills. And suddenly this 3,500 student school district that had served my white family so well was now $172 million in debt. And you could see that rippling through the entire community. There were like teachers being laid off and the school districts cutting programs and services, but also property taxes skyrocketing, home values stagnating, infrastructure going unrepaired, you know, all of these problems starting to compound, and then realizing that there was this demographic shift that overlaid that. So Penn Hills Public Schools, 72% white when I graduated in 1994, but by this point, 63% black. And so that was the initial hook for me of saying, what the heck is happening in my hometown? And then from there, I really wanted to understand if it was just my hometown, if this was happening in other suburban communities around the country. And so for the approach for the book really takes both of those things together. So there's, on one hand, it's kind of a big idea book, and this idea of suburbia being not just a Ponzi scheme, but a racialized Ponzi scheme, where you have this kind of explicit and heavy racial dimension to it, with black and brown families coming in as the third, fourth generation of a suburban community, and in many ways being left to pick up the burdens and the expenses that families like mine have already enjoyed. But then also telling that as a human story. So there's five families in five different suburban communities around the country, including my hometown, where I follow families and like, how are they encountering this cycle, this dynamic in an everyday level, starting in the school systems?
I told you I struggled with the book. I did struggle with the book.
Can you tell me more about that? What did you struggle with?
I want to talk to you about this because I feel like it's central to what you tried to do. And it's actually like the antithesis of what I've tried to do. And yeah. I think that those things are interesting. There's an interesting like tension there between your experience and my experience and how we describe that experience. So when you quote me in the middle of the book, which I was not like, I did not know that was in there. And all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, wait a sec. You quote me with the slash and burn statement that I've made. And I make that a lot. So like that was very, very familiar with me. The idea that suburban post-war development is slash and burn style of development. You go in, you essentially utilize up the resources, and then affluent people like move on to the next thing. But you also made a statement in that exact same kind of portion of the book where you said, you know, that I, Chuck, don't use a racial lens to look at this. And you do. You use a very heavy racial lens throughout the entire book.
Yes.
I want to talk about that because, you know, we're two white guys talking about this. I think maybe it would be healthy to sure. understand why you chose that. And then I'd like to also maybe talk about it a little bit because, I mean, clearly that's a big thrust of the book. So mm-hmm. what is it about the racial lens that is motivating to you or made you think that like that's the thread of this narrative that you brought forth in this book, which, by the way, I'll just say again, incredibly well written. Like it was much like other books I've read that are like this. You flip the page and not wanting to flip the page, but knowing that you have to, right? Like, oh my gosh, this is a painful story. So go ahead, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first part was wanting to accurately describe the reality that I was seeing on the ground. And in all of these communities that I focused on, and then looking nationally as well, like I think the demographic changes of suburbia are actually one of like really the most undercovered stories in America of the last 25 years. The diversification of suburbia is huge. And it's huge for a couple of reasons. So one is historical. So many, particularly of our post-war suburban communities, were, you know, racially exclusive and economically exclusive by design. And that's right. baked into the foundation, and that's baked into these first few generations of families, predominantly white and middle-class, upwardly mobile families, who are able to benefit from the communities when they actually work and when they're actually delivering this generous social contract that they promise. And so one of the like the takeaways for me, like statistics like that I still have to stop and remind myself of sometimes, is that suburban public schools are now majority non-white. Like white kids are already a minority inside suburban public schools. So we still have all of this imagery of, you know, Leave It to Beaver and the Wonder Years and all of that, but it actually doesn't describe reality. And so one of the communities that I focus on in the book is Compton, California. And I think that becomes a great example of why highlighting race was so important to me. Because again, Compton has this history of it was an all white by design, by statute, by racially restrictive covenants and a variety of other means, all white right up until the early 1950s. And then it went through all of these changes afterwards. But we forget that. And so we don't think of Compton as a suburb because it's not predominantly white anymore. But it's still the same land. It's still, you know, bungalow-lined blocks and primarily residential. And, you know, it's still the same place. It's just a different population. So our notion, part of, you know, bringing in race this way is to kind of complicate and make more accurate our notion of what a suburb actually is and who lives in suburbia. And then I think right. The second part of that is, you know, remember that I'm a schools reporter by background in education. And so I really came to this project initially I wanted to understand what families' experiences were in suburban public schools, particularly those that are changing quickly demographically, and particularly suburban families of color's experience. And what I heard over and over and over again, not just in my own reporting, but in research literature that I was drawing from, was that there was this profound disappointment, this sense of suburbia. You know, we have, you know, all of the post-war dreams that went into it around, you know, building the white middle class and so forth. But it was actually a real focus of the civil rights movement, too. This idea of opening up suburbia, fair housing and ending segregation of schools, like those were two of the primary goals of the civil rights movement. And so when that happens and suburbia opens up and you see suburbia diversify in this way, and families doing everything quote unquote right, doing everything they're quote unquote supposed to do, and getting into a community where you have a nice house on the nice cul-de-sac with the highly regarded public school, and still feeling like, hey, this dream I thought was supposed to come to me is not actually delivering, it's not actually happening. Like, that's a really profound thing. For me, from my perspective, not acknowledging and highlighting the centrality of race in that would be to miss a key part of the story.
Absolutely. I get that part of it. As I was reading the book, you titled the book Disillusioned, which I feel like captures the sentiment of people who, in the language that I would use, got a marketing brochure for what suburbia was and then lived it, and it wound up to not be the marketing brochure, right? I was thinking, like, if I had written this book, how would I describe it to people? And I would say, like, living in the twilight of the suburban experiment. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain amount of, I'll say it in my way, and I want you to say it in your way. There's a certain amount of this experiment that we're living through, the most disenfranchised, the least empowered people end up holding the bag in this almost game of like staying ahead of the steamroller, you know, the slash and burn part of the agriculture. Like, the people who do well in that are the people who move on to the next place and then slash and burn that. And the people who do horrible are the people who get stuck or have no other option or are the last kind of sucker at the card table who are left behind to deal with the denuded, you know, landscape that has no more nutrient to it. I've written about Ferguson, Missouri, which I feel like isn't, you mentioned it in the book too, but is an analog to Compton in a lot of ways because they were the shiny suburb, went through this transition and now are kind of known for being a place that deeply, deeply struggles. How much of this is and I think this is where I kind of struggled with the book as like a cause and effect narrative, because it's very easy for me to see like the poorest people in my community. I'm in central Minnesota. I don't know if you knew that. I mean, we have Norwegians and Swedes and Finns, you know, there's like lots of diversity here. And you know, I watch like the poorest people in the community get stuck holding the bag over and over and over and over. I feel like you were describing that exact same situation, but there is this racial dimension too. How much of it do you think is cause and effect? In other words, race causes the outcome versus effect. The suburban experiment causes this outcome, and disproportionately poor people, which it overrepresented in minority communities, get stuck holding the bag.
Yeah, I think
is that me, a fair question? Like, does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's a great question, and it's a great thing to talk about. And for me, I think really the starting point for thinking about the kind of cause and effect question is how the communities were designed. And so looking at communities that were both formally and informally racially exclusionary, in some cases entirely, in some cases, you know, largely all white and middle class, but you have like a small pocket of a place. There's that original sin that's kind of baked into a lot of suburban communities. And I think a lot of what we're seeing now is kind of reckoning with the long-term effects of that. But as it plays out in any individual community in any individual stretch of time, I mean, I do think that what you're seeing also, there is obviously a heavy economic component to it as well. And it's the overlay of race and class that I think we see, you know, it can vary from region to region and place to place. And what it looks like in central Minnesota is going to be different than what it looks like in Southern California. But, you know, I think pretty consistently with that national lens, you'll see that the race class overlap is unfortunately very tight in America. And you'll see that, you know, that particularly for, you know, I think part of what's so challenging about this dynamic is that we have these racial wealth gaps and economic divides within communities. And so what we see is that we have really put forth making it to suburbia as the answer to that. If we can just get more poor families, disadvantaged families, families of color into suburbia, then we'll solve our inequality problems. And that's part of why this dynamic and this disillusionment that so many families, particularly families of color, are experiencing is so profound, because this, it's not just like this was one option among many. Like, we have really touted this as the answer to the good life. And when it's not delivering, like, the consequences are profound, not just financially, but also, you know, kind of for like the spirit and psyche of the nation.
I feel like that's such a powerful insight, because we do hold this up like, okay, well, we just gotta, you know, make it so that people of all races and all incomes can buy a house in suburbia, then they'll be better off. Well, let me back up a little bit. I interviewed someone a couple of years ago who, you know, said basically like his wife, her dream growing up in a poor Black neighborhood, her dream was always to get to the suburbs. And like, that is what they looked at as success. And when they were able to buy a home in the suburb, they felt like, we finally arrived. Like, we have our part of the American dream. Now we have our bit of prosperity. And it was hard for me to look at that and not be humbled by the idea that this would be someone's dream, right? Like I understand why that dream is in your head. And I also was a little bit conflicted with the idea that I looked at that aspiration as somehow wrong, right? Like, oh my gosh, you don't want that. Like, you don't want to be the last person in, because you're going to be left holding the bag. Like I said, you're going to be living in the twilight of this thing. It felt like a lot of your families that you covered were very like my friend's wife, where it was like, this was the thing they were promised, but they are, in a sense, like the last one in the door, the last one left holding the bag. Is that by design? Is that just what has happened? Like, how did we get to that point?
I do think that there is a heavy element that is a product of the original design and intent of the communities. And I think we see that continuing to contaminate, like, not just the communities that we have, but the development patterns that go on from them and the social dynamics and social fabric within that community. And I'll give you an example from the book that I think speaks directly to what you're saying. So one of the families that I followed, they're named the Robinsons. They're an upwardly mobile, middle-class, professional Black family in the Atlanta suburbs.
So they're in Gwinnett County, right?
Right, Gwinnett County. So multiple.
Our audience should be very familiar with Gwinnett County, because we've talked a lot. Joe Minicozzi has done a lot of studies on Gwinnett County, and we've chatted about them here. And that's a disaster.
Part of what was so compelling and alarming to me about getting to know the Robinsons in their story. He was a network engineer and a middle school teacher. She was working on a PhD in public health. They had a nice house almost as far north in Gwinnett County as you can get, where it was still predominantly white, highest regarded, you know, cluster of schools, feeder pattern of schools in the county. So they, again, really thought that they were getting it. And like, that was not the experience that they had. And they were hardly alone in that. So, you know, you talked about this kind of feeling of having arrived. One of the advocates that I talked to in Gwinnett County is a woman named Marlene Tillman, and she had founded this organization called Gwinnett Stop that was really about unfair racial disparities in school discipline in the public schools there. But she had coined a whole term around this. She called it "I have arrived" syndrome. And she said, you know, so many upwardly mobile Black and Brown families come here feeling like, okay, I made it, I can like relax. And then the knife kind of gets plunged in and you have to deal with it. But part of what was so compelling for me about the Robinsons' experience was that it was the second generation of Anthony, the father. His parents had experienced the exact same thing in DeKalb County, one ring in closer. They had started wanting to go to DeKalb in the late 1970s when it was like the biggest like suburban magnet in the Southeast, particularly for middle-class Black families. And it took until the mid-90s for them to actually make it there. But again, went there feeling like, okay, like we have finally made, we have like the nice house and the subdivision in Stone Mountain. And, you know, there's like a pool there and there's, you know, tulips on the carve out when you drive in. And then like within a year, it was like, where did all the white families go? Why is Memorial Drive, all the shopping turning into, you know, pawn shops and flea markets? What is happening here? And so this idea that like we can keep finding it further one ring out, I think is really kind of baked into like the experiences that families are having. And it's baked into that disillusionment and that sentiment, because it's not just, hey, this isn't working for me. This hasn't worked for generations now.
I think you're getting close to what I'm struggling with. I'm trying to enunciate it as clearly, because I want you to push back. I feel like you have experiences and you have insights that I don't have and I don't share, and I'm interested in learning. Part of why I struggled with the overtly racial lens on this book is that oftentimes the solution coming out of that is we need to become a more racially harmonious society. Like, I understand that. And I think that there's a lot of good that would come about in that. And there's a lot of methods for us to get there. But I also strongly think that if race were not an issue, if we had worldwide had one race, and like in the United States, we had one race, like there was no racial differences, we would still have the suburban experiment, and it would still be grinding down the poorest families. And that group of poorest families would be growing and growing, growing proportion of the conversation because of the nature of this like land use pattern and this development pattern. Our whole thing here at Strong Towns is trying to give that definition, explain that, and arrest that decline, have us reinvest and do something differently. And I'm not saying that the racial conversation is a distraction. I see how it is central to the narrative, but the way that you address the problem of, I lived in DeKalb and I was the last person into DeKalb County. Now I'm the last family into Gwinnett County. Now I'm going to be the last family into the next county. There's a certain investment strategy that has to shift regardless of like anything else. Like, we have to have a way to build wealth, like within the community, within the families that are there. Like, I wish people had never left DeKalb County and we could have made it a better place. I've thought a lot about your book the last couple of weeks because I've read it and I've just been pondering and pondering and pondering, like, what do I do with this? Go ahead and react to that.
Yeah. Well, first, I'm glad that it made you think and made you ponder on it. So that's a good thing to start with. And I think, you know, I think about it a lot in terms of both diagnosis and prescription, and trying to keep those separate at times and then look where the overlap is with the Venn diagram. And so I think, sure, I'd argue with you some on the diagnosis point first. So this idea that we would have had this development pattern even if there were no race or racism in the United States. One, that's a very big if. But two, that my understanding, my sense of the history of the post-war suburban development in particular, is that it really is fundamentally about race. It's fundamentally about providing an escape valve for white families who are, you know, upset about a changing society, but really upset mostly about Brown versus Board of Education. And it's the desegregation of schools and public amenities that is really fueling the development pattern to start with, and part of why it takes root so much over in so many places at once. And so there's a policy dimension to it, but there's a social dimension to that as well. For me, you can't separate out that initial impetus and history that is baked into the design of the communities and the land use pattern that you're describing. There is this kind of important distinction between diagnosis and prescription. So even in my case where I say, look, part of the problem that I am diagnosing here is not just the land use pattern, but it's the racial element of the land use pattern that continues to fuel this cycle, there also then becomes the question of what do we do about it? What's the best kind of political strategy to arrest the decline, to reinvest in communities and so forth? And there, I think, you know, one of the communities that I focus on in the book is Evanston, Illinois. And for me, this became like, in many ways, a, you know, kind of a cautionary tale about the progressive politics of this. So, you know, I think many of the folks at Evanston would probably read Disillusioned and say, yes, I think Ben has diagnosed this accurately. Like, the race is central to this, you know, and this kind of like history of race racism is systemic and we need to rebuild systems top to bottom, et cetera. But then it's their policies and the approaches. And again, I look at this primarily through the lens of public schools. But what we saw there was a group of progressive parent activists of color, mostly younger, taking control of the school board and really saying, we're going to make racial equity the first and last thing we do with every policy decision. And it flows directly out of that diagnosis. But I think what we saw in Evanston, and I'm guessing you would say you probably have seen this in like land use circles in different communities as well, is that the kind of progressive playbook for how do you, you know, what's the medicine that you prescribe for the ill that you've diagnosed? Like in my world anyway, in schools, a lot of that playbook is very untested and very new. And so we have these kind of like menu of policy solutions that school systems will try to do to advance racial equity and address these historic wrongs. But many of them don't really have much empirical evidence yet. They provoke this strong backlash. There's, I think, a very open question as to whether that's the best path forward to try and direct change. That for me remains an open question. Does not mean we should overlook the centrality of race in diagnosing the problem that we're talking about.
Let's come back to schools, because I feel like there's a huge depth there that you have that I'd like to explore. I'm a Minnesotan. We're not very argumentative types. So this is as argumentative as I'll get ever. I want to push back on something, and I want to give you room to react to it. Sure. I remember going to graduate school. My undergrad's in civil engineering. My graduate degree is in urban planning. Let's just say, in the civil engineering program, there's no discussion. Maybe there is today, but there was no discussion in the 90s about racial disparities. Like, you know, it was just not part of the dialogue. But in graduate school, obviously, lots of conversation about this. And I remember the descriptions to me, and they almost use the exact words that you just used. This is a racially driven, you know, race is central to the conversation of the post-war suburban expansion. This is really like a racially motivated thing. And I remember sitting in class struggling with that mentally, because I come from a place that is like literally 99% white. The only non-white people that live here were people who were essentially adopted by white families. And so they were, for all practical purposes, culturally exactly the same as everybody else here. Yet we have the exact same development pattern. The wealthy people fled the city, moved to the countryside. They have large places. You know, the city itself became poorer, became less invested in. Those neighborhoods went into decline. And then as I got older and started to kind of diagnose the financial part of this, I mean, leading up to this growth Ponzi scheme insights and all that, what I saw is a development pattern that the affluent could stay in front of, and the poor would get trapped in, and it had no racial dimension. It's only a class dimension here. So that's as mean as I get in pushing back on something. Explain to me what I'm missing out of that. Because I recognize that in large cities where there's more racial diversity, and I said this in the book, like race is an accelerator in these places. There's no doubt. Redlining is a very real phenomena, and it transferred wealth disproportionately to some neighborhoods as the other. Tell me what I'm missing here in small town America that I'm not grasping.
Well, I mean, I think part of it would be just what you just said, like central Minnesota is by no means America writ large. And so, you know, I think when we see this, you know, in a lot of places, the dynamics, the racial demographics look very different in a lot of different places. And I also think we have to remember, and you, like you've written about this extensively and point out, like this is federal policy too. This isn't something that just like emerged out of the market. This was something that was, you know, from the New Deal on through post-war era, something that really, you know, federal government steered actively. And that steering, I mean, and you know this history well, like the redlining history, the mortgage investment history, like all of that, like racial segregation is explicitly baked into that from the very beginning. So, you know, I think that doesn't preclude it from happening in places where that are racially homogenous. And I do think that there is a development pattern. Like one of the ways that I've come to think about it, and that like schools, I think, becomes a powerful lens for this, is that so much of our sense of what it means to give our kids good life and opportunity is to be able to be in a place where we can exclude the people we don't want them to end up like. Sure. And in some cases, that's predominantly poor people. In some cases, that's predominantly people of color or immigrants or people who speak other languages. In many places, it's people who fit in all three of those categories to some degree or another. But I think that it's that ability to exclude, and then the kind of willingness and the mindset of just kind of moving on when things start to break down rather than repairing and reinvesting. I think it can happen in a variety of contexts. But when we look at it from the you know, the policy lens that kind of fueled it, and from, you know, the bulk of America where we see it happening. Like, for me, I just think it's hard to see how race is not core to a lot of what's going on.
I feel like what you just said is one of the most important insights from our movement, Strong Towns. And also, I feel like one of the takeaways from your book, this idea of moving on versus staying in a place and renewing it. I will acknowledge that I had not heard of like Black Wall Street in Tulsa and the Tulsa race. I never heard of any of that until, you know, 2 decades ago. Like, it was never part of my education growing up. It was never part of my college experience. Like, I came across this the way that probably many people did, where this was raised in our consciousness by basically advocates who thought we should know about this. And I'm grateful for that. But as I've gone back and looked at that, as I've gone back and tried to understand that, I recognize that to me, the story here is less about the destruction. Horrible, makes me sick to my stomach. Like, there's a whole story there. But to me, the most fascinating thing about Black Wall Street is how it built itself, like, out of nothing. How people started in this very like disadvantaged place, how people started with very little resources and cultivating from within, built this thing that was, in a sense, such a threat to the outside community that the outside community turned on it. I feel like that there's that renewal notion that the suburban experiment doesn't provide, that to me was, I'm not saying was absent in your book, because your book wasn't about the suburban experiment the way we talk about it, but I felt like all the families were struggling with a way to renew their place, and they were trapped in this system that is not about renewal, but is about moving on to the next place. Is that fair?
I think it is. And I think Evanston, again, becomes a powerful kind of counterpoint. And so, you know, you do have, you know, a relative handful of suburbs. I think the majority of which would be pre-war suburbs, in Evanston's case, really a late 19th century when it started to form, where you have this kind of history of slower development, which, you know, I think very much fits in with the Strong Towns argument and worldview. And you also have this kind of history of, there's been a Black community in Evanston since 1880, you know, like, there's a long, rich history there. And so what you see, you know, I think in a place like Evanston is it is able to renew and repair itself, in part because it doesn't have to fix everything all at once, and in part because it has maintained its ability to remain exclusive enough and has enough wealth kind of baked in by virtue of it being a college town and so forth, that it's able to do that. It has more resources to do the work more, and an environment where it can do the work more slowly. But that is absolutely, I think, really the exception. And I think, you know, part of what we see is, like, you know, the mindset of we'll just move on. Like, part of what was really challenging for me with the book was to realize how deeply that was part of how I grew up. And so, you know, my family left Penn Hills. Like, I left Penn Hills in 1994 and didn't look back. And my dad ended up leaving about 15 years later and not looking back either. And so part of that was, like, when I sat down and talked with my dad, you know, one of the things he told me was, like, listen, I just wasn't very interested in being a good community person. And it was like, oh, that's how I grew up. And this idea of, like, I don't owe anything to my neighbor next door, let alone to the people who are going to live here in 25 years. That idea, like, it was totally foreign to me until I really started, you know, writing and researching this book and, you know, thinking about my own experience as part of it. And yeah, I think that that mindset is, like, I mean, it's a very American thing in general, this idea we just, you know, we can always start over on the frontier. Like, that goes back as far as we're here. You know, I think that suburbs are in many ways an extension of that. And this idea of, like, if we run into problems, our history starts to catch up with us, we just move. And I do think we're running up against the limits of that now. And then also the, you know, again, with race being a key part of this, the demographic changes in America, like, it's harder to find 90 plus white percent communities and school systems anymore.
And now I'm going to sound like the far left person. The suburban experiment seems to be set up, well, and I've argued that this is the impetus of it, to create this consumptive economy where you measure success based on transactions, not on family wealth, family capacity, neighborhood wealth, community capacity, you know, overall prosperity. I wonder if we're nostalgizing too much. Me, the kind of pre or the 19th century community, did people care about each other more and that kind of thing? But I will say, in a lot of the places, and I've been to Plano. I've been to Gwinnett County. I've been to Evanston, Illinois. Like you were talking about places that I've experienced for the most part. I've not been to Compton, but I've been to, I think, every other one that you've discussed. There is a certain correlation up to a point where the poorer and more struggling the neighborhood becomes, often I've experienced the social bonds being stronger. And the more affluent the neighborhood becomes, there's a point where that doesn't hold, where people are desperate and the social bonds aren't there. But the more affluent the neighborhood becomes, the less social bonds there are. And the more people, I think, feel free to just treat it as a consumptive good. Am I overstating, you think?
I don't think that you are. And I'll speak to two examples from the book that I think, what you're saying resonates with. So one, you know, again, would be my experience in Penn Hills. So when I came back to Penn Hills in 2020, you know, I met Bethany Smith, who's an African-American mom who bought the house three doors down from my childhood home in 2018. And in many ways, I kept coming to her with this argument of saying, like, things are so bad here. Like, what are we going to do about it? What do you think about it? Like, how did things get this? Like, what, you know, all of these questions. And what she was kind of really saying is like, listen, I'm the one who has to live here now. So I don't have time to worry about all this other stuff. I have to worry about how do I make this place work? You know, and I think that's something I came away with a real appreciation with that I didn't understand either by virtue of my own experience growing up in suburbia in a different generation or by my, you know, based on my misconceptions and the myths that I still held about suburbia now, is that I think in a lot of these communities, you do see particularly parents organizing, really working around these issues. And a lot of times I do think it starts in school, and it could be the discipline code. It could be, I want a dress code that isn't going to punish my child because she wears braids in her hair. It might be I want more diverse teaching staff. Sometimes it's around infrastructure. We want the roads to get fixed, the potholes to get filled. You know, we want those things, but we do see a lot of that organizing happening. I think part of what makes it challenging in suburbia is there's not a real social civic infrastructure that facilitates that. So you're really working up, you know, kind of swimming upstream from the beginning when you start that work. In the context of Gwinnett County as well. And so Marlin Tillman, the founder of Gwinnett Stop, who I mentioned earlier, who talked about I have arrived syndrome, you know, part of what she kind of came away with saying, she was like, listen, I grew up in West Philadelphia in a neighborhood that was, you know, an intact Black neighborhood in the 1960s where you had doctors and lawyers and, you know, kind of hack cab drivers and, you know, hairdressers living side by side or a block away. And had moved away from that. And she had come to the suburbs and spent most of her adult life in the suburbs, first in Montgomery County, Maryland, then in Gwinnett County. And so what she said is like, you know, I walked away from this realizing that part of the price of making that move was adopting this kind of dog eat dog kind of mentality of like, we're all in it for ourselves and we have to do better than the next person. And that's how we protect ourselves. And so like for her trying to start this advocacy organization that would, you know, was trying to get powers and numbers to change the disciplinary system in Gwinnett County Public Schools, she struggled with that for years because it was so antithetical to the kind of mindset that had drawn so many people there and the social fabric that had emerged around that.
The marketing brochure of Gwinnett County is that you can live in isolation from your neighbors, right? Like you can have space, your own space, and you don't actually have to interact with your neighbors, right?
You know, I follow a white family in North Dallas,
the Susan Plano and Jim one. Becker.
They started in Plano, and then when it began, you know, diversifying and aging, they move out to a new ex-urban community called Lucas that's even further from downtown. And, you know, Jim, the dad, who's a corporate restructuring consultant, a really nice guy. And so when I talked to him, you know, they had just bought this new house and, you know, it's 5,000 plus square foot McMansion in this kind of like, you know, subdivision in an ex-urban community. And I was like, well, what do you like about it? He's like, oh, I can step out in the front yard and no one talks to me. And so that is very much a part of not just the kind of social fabric in the way that works, but like what we bring to it.
Let's talk about schools. I mean, obviously I have kids that are in school. I went through school. My wife and I both went to school here in our small town. My parents ended up being teachers, but not until I was older. So I didn't grow up with teachers, but my dad became a teacher when I was in junior high and my mom, when I graduated high school. You're an education reporter. You have that background. You talk a lot about the experience of schools in a book and some of those stories, the ones in with the Robinsons were heartbreaking. I mean, they really were. I can see the kid, the young boy struggling, not being understood. And I can see the young girl having this like hope and opportunity and not being given that. Let me ask the big question, like how central are schools to this whole conversation, this whole feeling of being disillusioned? from your frame, is like that an arrestable problem? I mean, it's to me, part of the school thing seems like a, again, kind of a little bit downstream from the bad course we've set ourselves on.
That's interesting. I think I had come to start to think of it almost in the opposite way.
Let me say this in the most ungenerous way possible. I think there's a lot of people, particularly elite educated people, who think that the answer to a lot of these problems is better education. I personally think that better education is like downstream from both the problem and the resolution or the improvement of that problem. But I want to give you a chance to talk to the opposite view of that, because you do focus a lot on schools.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's two big reasons for that. So one, again, going back to the history. And so these communities really being formed, as we talked about, as an escape valve for predominantly white, middle class, upwardly mobile, aspirational families. And so like the house and the chance to build wealth is a big part of that. But really, schools are a huge, huge part of that. Even still, it's the first question a lot of families ask when they're particularly when they're going to suburbs, like, what's the school district? And so it's very central to their notion of the life that they want and the expectations they have for what that community is going to deliver, not just to them, but to their children and to their future. And so that's one. But then on the second issue, I mean, I think the changes that we're talking about, both the demographic changes and the kind of financial, economic, and policy changes that kind of come with that, I think we see them first in schools in many ways. And, you know, in some ways it makes sense because that's where the youngest kids are. And
right.
This idea that, you know, the demographic changes, these have been happening in suburbia for a long time. And so I think for me, that's where I really started to hear about this a lot first, was these, you know, again and again and again, experiences of parents of color in suburbia saying, why is my kid being criminalized for being a kid? And that happening kind of again and again. And so I do think that there is this lens that we can use when we look at the experiences that families have in school. And it's, you know, sometimes it's really big things, like, you know, the mom in Evanston, for example, her son's a first grader and he's called racial slurs in his first grade school. And like, yeah, that's a huge thing. And that's going to stop the presses, and it should stop the presses anyway. For Corey and the Robinson family in Gwinnett County, it's this kind of like creeping thing. And like, there's a story that I really kind of like walk away with, of like, it for me, it kind of crystallized. So there's all these discipline issues, right? So he's getting in trouble for rough housing and for tapping his pencil too loudly and spending too long in the bathroom. And then some slightly more serious stuff happens and the suspensions start to escalate. And the parents are very concerned of like, okay, wait, is he going to get sent to the disciplinary school or what's happening here? So they decide that they're going to, you know, as part of this whole process, at one point, the family decides that they need to go up to have a meeting at the school to try and get all of this resolved. And so again, African-American family. And what they say is like, okay, we want to bring in not just mom and dad and Corey, but we're going to bring Corey's minister, his coach, his mentor, his grandparents, and some of his closest adult friends who are friends of the family. And so we want to go up there. And from there, their perspective is, we're coming up here to say, hey, look, we're a good family. We have a lot of resources at our disposal.
Here's the support system. We love this kid.
Yeah. You can tap, like, we're the family you should be dreaming about. Like, all you have to do is ask, and we will bring tons of resources to bear to help. We just need to be able to work in tandem. And what they're told when they come up to the school system is those people can't come in because they're not your family. And so it's this idea of like really
kind of heartbreaking. Yeah.
Competing understandings of who matters, who counts, who belongs, and who deserves that kind of grace and kindness. And I ended up thinking about it a lot in juxtaposition to my own experience. So like when I talk about growing up in Penn Hills, like I was a disruptive kid too. I got bored and I would start like drawing on my desk and drawing on classroom furniture and doing all of the annoying things that kids do. And what my teacher did for me was bring in a typewriter from home. And she said, Ben, when you get bored, I'm not going to punish you. I don't want you to, you know, draw on your desk either. You just go back and use the typewriter and do whatever you want. I started my first class newspaper there, Up to Date with Room 38. It was like my first journalism job. You could see how it kind of opened doors for me. And like Corey was experiencing the exact opposite of that. And it was like part of the pain and the problem of that is the actual punishment, like he's missing school. In a deeper way, there's this sense of who you are doesn't belong here. Who you are doesn't count here. You have to change yourself if you're going to succeed in this environment. That was not something that I experienced, but I think something that lots of families of color today now experience in suburban public schools as well.
That was a painful story for me too, when I got that part of the book. When you told your story about the typewriter, when I was in first grade, my first grade teacher, I don't think liked me because I was disruptive and And I was disrupted because I was bored. My second grade teacher recognized I was bored and got me transferred into an accelerated learning program where I was, you know, middle of the pack, bottom of the pack of some like elite, like fast moving kids. It hurts. It makes me really, really sad when you recognize the potential that so many people have. And we have school districts that there's not the opportunity to recognize that and build on it, right? Because as you're describing this kid who's continually getting in trouble, the first thing in my mind is like, he needs to be inspired by something, right? Like he needs someone to love him like there and like be like, I see your potential, you know?
And he has that in his family, his coach, his mentor, all these people the family are trying to bring. And the school is actively saying, no, we refuse to see that. And I think that that's part of the, and again, back to the question of like, why schools or why school central to this? Like, I think that it can be hard. Like if you're a family and you want to move into a community and you're denied a mortgage loan, like that sucks and you really feel it. And it's like, this isn't fair. I know I make enough money to do this.
Yes.
But like there, it's different when it's your kid. And when it's like these kind of like, it's not this kind of like abstract systemic thing. It's like, my child is not being seen. My child is not being recognized and appreciated. His gifts are being either ignored or actively stifled. Like that is a very hard thing for a parent to deal with. And I think part of what, you know, again, became so compelling for me about the Robinsons in Gwinnett County is like the parents realize that by virtue of what they're experiencing, they become complicit in it as well. So they start telling their son, you know, don't sing, don't be loud, keep your hands to yourself, don't dress, don't be yourself. Don't be yourself. Exactly. And so that becomes a reckoning for them too. And so part of what, you know, again, what I hope people walk away from disillusioned with and why I'm so glad to have this conversation with you is because I really came away from this really believing that those moments that families like the Robinsons experience in their public schools are very connected to the land use patterns, the kind of growth Ponzi scheme issues, whatever. They're like maybe a second or third order symptom of like a root thing that's happening, but they're what we see and experience and feel. And part of what I hope people walk away from this is having both a framework and a language to be able to say, oh, when this type of thing happens to my kid in school, it's not just because that individual teacher is racist or discriminatory or prejudiced or whatever it may be, that may be happening as well, but really it's a function of this larger design pattern that we have, that we are not, like you described it as kind of like we're living in the twilight of it. And I think that's exactly right. And it's like, you know, that's something you really swayed me on, is this idea of like, hey, this is really just beginning and we have some rough waters ahead here.
As you describe your education experience, and then you contrast that with the education experience that, you know, of the Robinsons in Gwinnett County and in this like twilight of the suburban experiment, there's an undercurrent of it that I think suggests that the experience you had, and I'm going to put me in with you, the experience that I had was somehow like the optimum experience or a good experience. Like we should strive for that. But when I step back, I also recognize that it is an experience that was consumed by us as a society in what we at Strong Towns called like the illusion of wealth, like the craziest time of, you know, free spending insanity that we've ever had. Is that a reasonable standard to judge today by? And how much of our education system is essentially stuck in the 1950s version of what like optimum schooling looks like instead of what may be a more realistic? And let me say it in a different way. If you were poorer, you would have designed a different system that would be more effective than when you're richer. And now that we are actually having to confront the fact that we're not as rich as we pretended to be, we're still stuck with a system that consumes intense amount of resources. And when it starts to, I mean, as you described in your school system, consolidating schools and building new high, and basically like blowing all their money on consultants and buildings. And then when push comes to shove, gutting the staff, cutting teachers, cutting programs, you send kids to school in a nice, you know, 3/4 finished building to get inferior education. This all feels again, like downstream from this peak. So I guess my question is, do we look back at the experience you and I had and say, we're trying to get back to that? Or we do look back at that as like a delusion that we need to like wipe out of our brain and say, how do we constitute a good system today? One that actually helps families of all income levels, all races, like everybody have maximum achievement. That's what I struggle with as I read your education stuff in this book.
Yeah. And, you know, as you may be gathering though, I'm a kind of a both and guy. And so I tend to think both, and I'll tell you why. So in this case, I think that on one hand, you know, no, we should not be looking back and say, you know, the way that Penn Hills operated in 1984 is like the standard that we should want for everywhere. And that's part of the disillusionment that I talk about. Like the title Disillusioned of the book has kind of a dual meaning for me. So one, it's first and foremost, the disillusionment that so many suburban families of color in particular are experiencing, which we've talked about. But for me, part of the process as a white man who grew up in suburbia and left and is part of this cycle, it was really kind of having to come to terms with some of my own illusions and delusions about my own experience. So this idea of, you know, that my third grade teacher would bring in a typewriter, that's something that can happen. A version of that can happen in any school anywhere. And that's a function of people caring and seeing each other, like seeing me themselves in me and vice versa. And so that can happen anywhere. But the kind of exclusion, the kind of financial magical thinking, like all of the stuff that kind of made that brought me and my third grade teacher together, like that's not sustainable, nor realistic, nor desirable, I don't think. And so I think part of the challenge is that when we talk about like, okay, well, what do we do now? Is like, so do we really want to pour tons of money into a place like Penn Hills, where it has this really flawed foundation that like that money isn't going to magically fix this kind of, you know, the foundation and the flaws that are there. And so I think that does present a really, really difficult challenge. But I do think that there is some hope. And I walked away from Compton as a place like that. And so again, like when it bottomed out hard. And it was really, really troubled for a long time. And it's still a very tough place in many regards. But I spent time there, you know, I was following the Hernandez family, and both parents are undocumented. They have two children living in Compton who were born in the U.S., who are U.S. citizens. And they were at a school called Jefferson Elementary when I met. And so, you know, by this point, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020, Compton Unified School District, 96% Black and Brown, 80% Hispanic, overwhelmingly poor, lots of immigrant students, newcomer students, kids who don't speak English, their parents don't speak English, et cetera. And what I saw in Jefferson Elementary was like a 21st century version of that same social contract. So the boy that I'm following, Jacob Hernandez, he started his own class newspaper. And it was because his teacher saw that in him and helped pull it out of him. And there was a structure in place from top to bottom within that institution to say, hey, what we need to do, like when I talked to the superintendent about this, you know, he was very clear of like, I want kids, like he's very focused on technology and the tech sector and jobs. And he's like, I want kids who are not only going to be able to get jobs at Apple, which is, you know, as currently constituted, a pretty big stretch for Compton Unified, but I want them inventing the next iPhone. And so when I saw Jacob, he got to do all of the things that got him started to prime what you would want to prime a fourth grader for that. So not only was he doing class newspaper, I saw him doing mock trial competitions, robotics challenges, engineering lessons. I mean, you name it. The lesson that I like just loved so much and took away. So he's asked to write as a fourth grader, he's asked to write a narrative essay. And the subject is, imagine your first day working at Lucasfilms. And so he just like ate it up. Like you could just see him like fill up with life with this. And so his essay is, you know, I wake up, I get in my Tesla, I go over to the office, I say, hey to Luke at the water cooler, we design some new droids, I prototype a new lightsaber. And it's like, there's both the resources in place and the systems in place and the love and kindness and caring in place to say, you are a child who matters. You are a child who my future depends on what you do now. And the superintendent was explicit about that. He's like, that boy is going to be paying into my retirement. He is going to be the one that is going to like be, you know, the infrastructure of my community and my retirement home is going to depend on what that kid does. And unless we have that mindset, I think we're going to struggle. But I do think that we are seeing signs of hope in some places of like what it looks like to switch that.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you. Let's end with that, because that was a hopeful thought. I hope I've not given anyone the impression that this is a depressing book. There is a lot of hope in this book. There's a lot of good stories. There's a lot of compelling narrative here. And again, Ben, you're a great writer. I think people should get this book, should read it. It's very important. If people want to follow you and your work and what you're doing, what's the best place to do that?
Sure. Well, thank you for the compliments. And you can find me and the book online at benjaminherold.com. That's H-E-R-O-L-D, and at Benjamin B. Herold at Twitter. And I'm very excited to say that we're going to be sharing free copies of Disillusioned at the Strong Towns National Gathering later this spring in Cincinnati. So very excited for that.
Let's do that. Yes, you are. And I'm very honored and flattered and excited about that. I want people to get the book, and I want people to read it, and I want them to discuss it because it's very, very worth people's time. The book is Disillusioned, Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburban Experiment. Ben, thanks for your patience with me. Thanks for taking the time to chat. It's very kind of you.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thanks for the work that you and the Strong Towns community does. It was hugely influential for me, and I'm really glad we got the chance to talk.
Beautiful. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Take care.
Drastic times require what? Drastic measures, yes! Who said that?
They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Build, 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 build. That's the story.
Chuck Marone, this has been fascinating.
Who made the city?
I like you. I like your vision of the world.
The United Nations Earth Summit, Agenda 21. Yeah.